Hi. Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, August 29th, 1996. In the fireside room this morning, our speaker is Wes Howard Brook. Today he will be continuing his Bible study series on the Gospel of John. Today's session number is 9 and is titled, Preparing to Receive the Spirit, John chapters 13 through 17. Let's listen in.
Well, yesterday we were talking about foot washing, and we didn't quite finish the scene, and so I'd like to, before we get to just a few highlights of these farewell discourses, so-called Last Supper discourses, just to finish the scene dramatically, because then we're going to really do some bits and pieces of the rest of the chapters, and it's because it's obviously more than we can look at in detail. When we finished yesterday, I had left us at that place in chapter 13, verse 22, where Jesus had announced the presence of a betrayer, and the disciples looked around at one another, having no idea who it was. And, you know, we tried to think about why that could be, how that could be, that they could have been together all this time and not know that one of them was not with them. And I looked a little bit about the implications of developing intimacy as a vehicle for overcoming the possibility of betrayal. But the scene goes on for a few more verses, and it's very dramatic, so I'd like to just follow through that a little bit. Because it introduces a character who's really the central character other than Jesus in this gospel, and probably the central character in the Johannine community. And he's introduced, remarkably, precisely at this moment, where betrayal and confusion are the themes. Verse 23, there was leaning on Jesus' breast one of his disciples whom Jesus loved. A character never named, and so therefore known in the literature as the beloved disciple. One of the interesting things about John's gospel is some of the most important characters have no name. Jesus' mother, the woman at the well in Samaria, the person born blind, and now this one, known only as the one whom Jesus loved. Not a bad name, huh, to have. But he's introduced here at this scene in this very intimate position. Now, if people have been paying attention, not to something that we know, we've talked about explicitly, but to an image from the prologue, as I mentioned early on and repeated, the prologue is this overture that provides themes that echo throughout. Does that image of leaning on Jesus' breast bring back any image from the prologue? You can look at the Bible. It's not in my face. It's there in the prologue, in the first verses, if you'd like to not just wait for the answer. Right near the end.
The Son who is in the bosom of the Father?
Yeah. The beloved disciple is introduced as being in the same position in relationship with Jesus as Jesus is in relationship with the one he calls Father. Now, if that isn't a position of intimacy, and if it isn't meant to describe an intimate position, I don't know how else you could describe it. You know, leaning on his breast, on his bosom. That's where he is in the face of this community that's terribly confused, and as we'll look at in a minute, a community whose emotions range far, far deeper than just confusion. And this scene is a little bit comedic as the movement of it unfolds here. Simon Peter nodded to this one to find out, to tell him who it is about whom he's speaking. So that one leaned upon the breast of Jesus, repeated it for emphasis here, and said, Lord, who is it? Even the beloved disciple doesn't know who it is. And Jesus said, if the one to whom I give the morsel that I dip, and having dipped the morsel, he took it and gave it to Judas, son of Simon Iscariot. And after that, Satan entered into him, and Jesus said, what you're going to do, do quickly. And none of those reclining at table knew why he said this. Some imagined, since Judas held the treasury, Jesus was telling him, buy what we need for the feast, or they should give something to the poor. Now, folks, that's supposed to be funny. You know, it may be bitter humor, but can you imagine at this point that not only do they not know who it is, but they think that Jesus is telling Judas, in the midst of this conversation about betrayal, to go run an errand?
Yeah.
You know? Hello. It's kind of absurd, don't you think? That's the level they can think of, and they've quickly gone off from trying to worry about who the betrayer is, you know. But an errand at this point in the story? And in verse 30, it's just one of those things that even Shakespeare couldn't better, huh? And therefore he received the morsel and went out at once, and it was night. What's night about in John's gospel?
Darkness.
Darkness. Night is coming when no one can work. While it is day, we must work the works of the one who sent me. Night is coming when no one can work. And boy, is it here now. The rest of this conversation that goes on for four chapters takes place at night. And the disciples indicate over and over just how much they're in the dark. It's full of poignant emotion here. And if our hearts don't go out to these people, then we're pretty hard-hearted ourselves. And if we can't relate to their experience, then we're really not much on the path of discipleship. I'd just like to draw attention to a couple of things as an overview of the scene. As a matter of structure, we've been looking at a number of times these so-called chiasms, these five or seven part structural ways to break up a scene. In the whole five chapters, almost by chapters, it's broken up into these pieces. So chapter 13, 1 to 32 talks about the hour, it's Jesus' hour in this case, the disciples' mission and this elusive concept of glory. And that comes back in chapter 17 in Jesus' prayer to God on behalf of those around him and us, those who believe because of their word. And then the hour shifts to not Jesus' hour, but whose hour?
Satan's hour, I suppose.
Yes, indeed. We don't have to suppose. It says so. Their hour, and guess who else's hour?
Our hour.
And we'll look at that in a minute. Our mission, and whatever our glory might be. Then at the end of chapter 13, going through the end of 14, there's this mystery about Jesus in John's Gospel's language going away, the announcement of a paraclete, this question about asking in Jesus' name and the gift of peace. And all four of those themes come back again at the very end of 15 all the way through 16. At the very center of this discourse, chapter 15 is this powerful image of what it means to be church in John's Gospel's point of view under the metaphor of vine and branches. And we'll spend a few minutes looking at that too. Okay. There's also, I'd like to highlight, that's the structural overview. If you were to look in the book, I lay this out in great detail. Each one of these parts of this chiasm is itself a chiasm. And within some of those, the parts are even one layer deeper. 17 is, I think, the most beautiful one. It's the verses, of course, are later designations. They weren't written in the form of verses. Those markings didn't happen until the Middle Ages. But chapter 17, which consists of 26 verses, consists of five-verse chiasms. One of them is a six-verse chiasm. I mean, it's really, amazingly carefully constructed. And if we just tend to read straight through in a linear way and don't pay attention, we miss all that. Now, there's a reason for this. It's not just to be beautiful. There's a theological and a prayerful reason why it's constructed this way. What do you think it might be? What about this business of finding chiasms? For those of you who are new to it, consists of looking for parallels, either big theme parallels like in this overview, or when you're looking at particular verses, words that are the same or images, metaphors are the same. Is there a point to that, or is it just beauty for beauty's sake?
Well, it could be a way of teaching, so that you've got repetition, and then you're highlighting your most important part in the center.
Okay. Repetition. Thanks, Lori. I know. What's the point of repetition? Some people read these chapters, and they're often proclaimed in the common lectionary in the weeks after Easter, and then little pieces are taken out one at a time. And if you try and read it through, just read it through, it's things like, I've heard this before, it's repetition, and we want to think of it as boring, because we're so, you want action, and drama, and so the words just kind of go on and on, and it seems boring to us. But what's the value of repetition?
Repetition is how we learn. We have to keep emphasizing in different ways.
Okay.
Try to keep it new, but say the same truth.
Is it for the sake of memorizing?
Yeah, both those things, I think, are exactly the point. Memorizing Repetition, you know, to get you to emphasize it, and sometimes a different way, sometimes the same way. Advertisers know this. They can show you the same 60-second spot over and over and over again, and you might think, oh, I've seen this stupid commercial, but it still penetrates. Before you know it, you're humming the jingle.
It becomes part of our life.
Yeah, it just becomes part of your life, even if you're not consciously listening. Even if the moment the commercial comes on, you go to the kitchen to get something to eat, you know, it's in the back of your head somewhere. And whenever you see that product, you associate it with whatever they're trying to get you to associate with it. You know, beautiful young women or going out in the peaceful place in the earth or whatever their come on is. So there's that sense. It gets you to remember it. There's also a sense that the advertisers know and politicians know too, you know, in using repetition in this silly season of American politics, that there are a lot of voices competing for our attention. You know, there are things coming at us from all over the place, no culture more than ours, you know, where there's just information and input just, you know, everywhere. Their culture wasn't as bombarded, John's Gospel culture, wasn't as bombarded with information as we are, but there were still a lot of different voices competing for attention. And one way to penetrate what anthropologists call noise, you know, many different voices and messages competing for our ears and our minds, is to say your message over again, repeat it. So that it doesn't just become some movie you saw last week that just washes past you and is gone. So it's repetition for that sake. One other purpose I would suggest is to make it a form of prayer and meditation. You know, some of us, I'm sure, have used scripture as a form of prayer. You know, we take a particular verse and just be with it. It was a particularly Jewish form of prayer, remains that to this day. You know, we saw that in John 6, where that paraphrase of scripture, he gave them bread from heaven to eat, becomes a basis for 60 verses of commentary and discussion between Jesus and this Galilean crowd that becomes Judeans before the scene is over. For us, that may be more of an individual process, just sitting alone in our room in the morning or at night or whenever we can take a few minutes, and just being with those words and letting them just be with us. And one of the aspects of that, particularly in this Last Supper discourse, is in many ways the words are deceptively simple. You know, there aren't any strange words. They're all words as vocabulary that we know. In a way, we could read through this whole Last Supper discourse in 10 minutes and say, so what else is new? I already know all this. But I think part of the point of the chiastic structure and repetition is just to get us to slow down. And of course, I'm going to do just the opposite and have us zip right through it this morning. But for your benefit, when we don't are not limited to an hour, and you can create whatever time in your life you can block out, it's just to take a verse or two, or one of the chiasms, maybe 5 verses, and just be with it. Just read it again and again and again, and just let the words penetrate and reflect on what each of those little images might mean in your life individually or your life as part of your Christian community, your local home.
Well, what's the difference between a chiasm and say, a motif?
Well, the motif, we'll look at some of the motifs. Like, for example, Jesus going away is, you know, kind of a theme that runs through. But the chiasm is a particular way of structuring it.
Oh, okay.
So that it has this concentric pattern. They're coming out from the center.
Okay.
All the Gospels, you know, will have certain, any writing, really, any narrative writing has motifs, but they're not all structured in this way. They're not arranged that way.
Yeah. My first time here. How do you spell chiasm?
C-H-I-A-S-M. It comes from the Greek letter chi, which is an X, you know, with the center and then the things radiating out front.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. What a time it would be, a first time. I hope you're not totally confused, but thanks for asking the question, because I'm sure you're not the only person who didn't know what a chiasm was. Okay, well, before I sit down, one more element, and this may be more in your line, Carl, of a motif. As you look through, say, starting with chapter 14, we look through, feel free to glance at your book. What emotions do you see painted there, either directly from the disciples' words or Jesus telling them how they feel? What's the mood in this nighttime scene on the eve of Jesus' crucifixion? Is it just a big happy party?
It's giving them assurance.
Before we talk about what he's giving them, you know, what's the mood? What are they feeling?
Computer.
Fear, I think.
Trouble.
Fear.
Fear.
Confusion.
Abandonment.
Trouble.
Trouble.
Could you say betrayed?
Okay, let's write that down. Whether they're feeling betrayed or not yet isn't explicitly mentioned, but we can certainly infer that from the scene. That
they're also feeling the need to cram all that. I want to say denial is in there.
Indeed, denial. They're rich with denial. Denial, by the way, is one of the themes of a scene that we didn't look at, which is Lazarus' story. You know, where one of the challenges they have to face, and we have to face, is the denial of the impending presence of death, whether natural death at the end of a long life, or violent death, or accidental death, but, you know, just the possibility of certainty of death. Okay. Any others, feelings? One that's highlighted throughout is grief. Grief, you'll be mourning, weeping, and wailing. One that might seem like an emotion, it's not quite this, but I just want to put it on there because it's going to become a theme, is a sense of being hated. A term which I want to spend a little time with because it's one we're so uncomfortable with in our society. We never talk about it, except, you know, I hate a certain kind of food or something like that. We don't talk about it, certainly in the biblical theological sense, and so it's easily misunderstood or avoided because we're uncomfortable with it. So I want to make sure we highlight that one. But this is the mood here. Denial, trouble, and fear, confusion, abandonment, betrayal, grief. You're about to be hated and persecuted. Are we having fun yet? No. This is not a happy scene. But in the end, it's a hopeful scene. And the question is, how do you get from here to there? You know, John's gospel, I think, is remarkable in telling us and painting this picture for us of the way life often really is. You know, it's not just one big happy party. You know, we started off looking at the first thing that Jesus does, this creating this gigantic party in Cana of Galilee. You know, this wedding that already has run out of wine, and what does Jesus do? He makes more wine. He gets people drunk. You know, the first messianic act of Jesus is to get people drunk. There it is, right in the text. You know, it starts off with this big party, this infinitely large, no-holds-barred party, and now we're on the eve of all this stuff. What went wrong? You know, life's supposed to be a big party, and instead, Jesus' closest buddies are feeling all these terrible things. What's the matter? Why are they feeling all this? Why aren't they celebrating that Jesus has been with them and he's going back to the one who sent him and he's offered them, you know, the promise that they can be children of God just like him? And, you know, what's the matter? Something's terribly wrong.
Lack of faith.
They're scared too.
They're so human they can't visualize him going and coming back and getting
them? Yeah, I think lack of faith summarizes it in a certain way. Yeah, at one point in this gospel, or in this scene, Jesus will say, you know, something to the effect of, when you start to love me. That's the effect. Up till now, they don't. You know, they're with him. You got to give him credit for that. They're with him. That's about all you can say. They don't understand. They're afraid. They don't really understand. They don't know what Jesus is about to do. They don't know what they're supposed to do. But they're with him. They haven't abandoned him like so many of the people have. And hopefully, we can recognize that that's about where we are. Now, if we don't feel these feelings as Christians in the world, you know, what's different about our social reality than theirs? Why is it that when Jesus says to them in chapter 15, which we'll look at in 16, you know, the world will hate you and the world will persecute you and do all these things. Do we as Christians feel hated and persecuted by the world in our society?
No.
Is our society better, or are we something missing, or why do you think there's a difference?
Well, it's all so new then.
Okay. But you know, if we were having this conversation in El Salvador, we might say. That's exactly how we feel.
Yeah. I feel that way.
Okay. Why? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, I think a lot of it is with your family and friends that have deserted you because of your deep faith and your active faith.
If you don't mind, you know, if you don't want to talk about this any further, that's fine. But since you brought it up, if you don't mind my asking, I mean, is there something specific you can name that you've stood up for, that you've named as your faith, that has made people say, I can't associate with you because of that, or I can't accept that? Or...
Well, even my own children have done that to an extent.
But, I mean, is there something
yes,
specific?
They tell you that they don't want to hear it. And they
don't,
and they don't come around, and because of.
Well, a very simple example. Last weekend, we had some friends who wanted us to go out to their lake place and spend the weekend, you know, over Sunday. And I said, "Well, we really want to be in church on Sunday." Well, why do that? Why is that so important? I mean, it makes you almost feel guilty because you want to be in church instead of. Out of the lake.
Yeah. You know, in John's Gospel's time, and in Paul's time a generation earlier, there was a clear sense that Christianity was not consistent with the way the dominant culture of the era was. I mean, Paul talks about it in language not dissimilar from John's Gospel. You know, you're supposed to, you died with Christ and you rose, you're supposed to be dead to the world. You know, he writes to the Corinthians, who the Corinthian church is trying to fit in. You know, go to the feast where meat sacrificed to idols is served, and to engage in various other kind of cultural practices, going to the gymnasia where there's, you know, certain kinds of athletic events and other things that are related to the emperor and you know, Greek god, you know, pantheon of Greek gods worship and that kind of thing. And Paul says, you can't have your cake and eat it too. This commitment to baptism, this commitment to be part of this community, makes you different. You know, as the wonderful Southern writer Flannery O'Connor said, you know, paraphrasing John's Gospel, "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you odd." But we often don't see the commitment as requiring that, you know, because to be a part of a mainstream Christian church in this culture is just to kind of fit right in. In most places, it's not different than joining the country club or the PTA or any other social group. You know, the presidential candidates can refer to this as a Christian country and all these kinds of things. We have the Christian Coalition that thinks they're making it more Christian every day. I'd argue just the opposite, but that's just my opinion. It certainly seems on the surface of things that you can be a member, be a disciple of Jesus, and be a good American and fit right in with the materialistic culture, and to suggest otherwise is to have you labeled a communist or, you know, all kinds of funny things like that that are not really have anything to do with the label, but have to do with somebody saying, you know, what you're saying, I don't want to hear it. I don't like it. It's too threatening.
But in a sense, you want to comment on what Kenan Callahan has said, that we live in a post-Christian era, and he's almost saying that Christianity is irrelevant to what... what's going on in society.
And I couldn't agree more that true Christianity is irrelevant. Going to church and doing the nominal Christian things is totally accepted. Calling yourself a Christian is accepted. And I guess my challenge to us here, to myself as well as to all of us, is to say, if we were doing what this gospel calls us to do, we would feel all the feelings that these people are feeling. And the question is, why aren't we? Why aren't we?
Because we like feeling comfortable.
Yeah.
We don't want to be threatened.
I wonder if to some extent the emphasis on faith has led us to believe that being right with God is only a process of internal understanding. And intellectual understanding about what we do materially with our lives in the secular world is apart from that. So we can lead this kind of almost double life, where we go through certain motions to feed ourselves, clothe ourselves, and shelter ourselves. But as long as inside we have faith, that's all that matters.
Right? The emphasis in the church's teaching, and you know, the church generally speaking, has been orthodoxy instead of orthopraxis, right thinking rather than right doing, with the one exception of sexuality, a topic that the Gospels say almost nothing about. And that's the one area where the church is always looking over people's shoulders, you know, to see what you're doing. Not economics, not, you know, who you associate with or don't associate with, or, you know, a hundred other issues that the Gospels are constantly emphasizing, but just this one area that the Gospels barely even touch on. But you get off on that one, but I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on that right now. I just wanted to get us in touch with this, with why some of the language of this Last Supper Discourse may seem strange and irrelevant to us. And it's partly because I, just my suggestion, you're welcome to disagree, or I just put it out there for you to ponder, that it seems that way because, you know, the churches have made this compromise with the world. And this gospel couldn't be more precise. This gospel is not all of Christian tradition. I want to emphasize that again and again. It's just one of the gospels. The Gospels are just part of the New Testament, and the New Testament is only part of the Christian tradition. But at least within this Gospel, there is no Christ in culture, as Reinhold Niebuhr presented as one of the options of the relationship between the church and society. This is, you're in the world, but not of the world. The hardest option of all. You know, one other one that was around at this time was the Qumran option, you know, go off to the desert. Stay at Holden forever. You know, let's just go away. Let's just remove ourselves from it completely and form our nice holy community, our monastic community, or whatever form of it is, you know, out in the desert or up in the mountains or wherever that might be. And this gospel says, no, that's not the solution. You're not supposed to be part of the world, but you're not supposed to be removed from it either. You're supposed to walk this knife edge of being in it, but not of it. And boy, that's a tough one. And so these chapters are trying to give us what we need, a little bit of inspiration and some practical advice of how that's possible. Because for the early church, it wasn't any easier, and maybe harder than it is for us now. The temptation toward accommodating, toward fitting in, is one that goes all the way back to 1 Samuel 8. People know 1 Samuel 8? You know, we want to have a king like everybody else. We don't want to be different. Everybody thinks we're weird. You know, these Israelites, their king is God. You know, they have this tribal confederacy where everybody's equal. We want to have a king like everybody else. We don't want to be different. You know, that's, of course, the Jewish struggle throughout three millennia of how to be true to who God has called the Jewish people to be and live in a world that rejects, you know, Jews, as being different, odd. Christians haven't had to face that because of the Holy Roman Empire, et cetera, et cetera. But maybe we need to try and grapple that a little bit. Okay. So a few things that the gospel offers us as a way to try and come to grips with this. And that's where we start in chapter 14. We've got a half hour to try and glance at some of this. I'd just like to highlight a few of the images and scenes that are partly most powerful and partly most misunderstood. To give you some thoughts. Starting right here at the beginning of chapter 14. Do not let your heart be troubled. And our translations, I'm sure, have that plural, huh?
Yes.
Hearts?
Yes.
Interesting, because in the Greek it's singular. It's a collective singular. Your is plural and heart is singular. Emphasizing that Jesus is talking to the community as a whole. Do not let your plural, heart singular, be troubled. Have faith in God and have faith in me. And that may seem like a, you know, a big fat platitude, but in this context, that's a serious admonition here, because up to this point, they don't. And this is one of this next image is one I'd like to focus on. In my Father's house, there are many, and the Greek word is mone, abodes. How do your Bibles have it translated?
Rooms,
dwelling places. The classic one is mansions, which makes you think of, you know, there's this big house for everybody in the sky, you know? Yeah. Otherwise, I would have told you, because I'm going to prepare a place for you. If I go my way and prepare a place for you, I'm coming again and will receive you to myself. That's where I may be, and where I'm going, you know the way. Now, what about these dwelling places? In my Father's house, there are many dwelling places. Where is Jesus' Father's house? Is it in the sky?
Could be wherever we go.
Good point. Thank you. Boy, that's the easiest I've ever gotten anybody to answer that. There was no need to cover your face. That was beautiful. Yeah, wherever we go. Where was it for the Judeans of the time? The temple. Well, by this time, the temple's rubble. It's not there. Jesus is clearly not talking about go to the temple. In the temple, there are many dwelling places. That's not the physical building. And in fact, when he's referred to my Father's house, he's referring to the temple in chapter 2, and they talk about the temple, and he's talking about his body. And since Jesus' body isn't physically there anymore, but we are that body, hence Jesus' Father's house is wherever the Christian community is. So what are these dwelling places then? In my Father's house, wherever we go, there are many dwelling places. What might that be?
Homes.
What kind of homes?
Christian homes.
Like house churches, maybe. Yes. The term specifically comes from, it's a traveler's image. It refers to the kind of place you would stop along the journey for a night's rest. A lot like, you know, the inn, no room at the inn in Luke's infancy story. And I just like to suggest, there's no clear answer here, but just, you know, as one possibility, that it's precisely that. That within the Christian community, there are many places to stop. There are many house churches along the way. There are many places where you can feel welcome. You're not going to be completely alone in this journey. You know, you can find support, you know, along the way in many different places. And then Thomas, who we haven't heard of together here at all, but his last line was, when Jesus had heard that Lazarus was sick and Jesus was off on the way, and they said, you're not going back to Judea where they're going to kill you, are you? And he said, we're going. And Thomas says with bravado, let's go and die with him. Now, whether that's bravado or sarcasm or not, you can decide for yourself. But here he comes up again. Lord, we don't know where you're going. How can we know the way? Am I the only one that thinks that's funny? At this point in the story, Lord, we don't know where you're going.
He's all been telling.
Yeah, how long has he been telling?
That's right. You know? And, you know, these poor people, I mean, I don't want to make fun of them, but it really is, you know, quite poignant. And then Jesus has one of his wonderful John's Gospel lines. I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. If you had known me, I'm suggesting you don't, you would have known my Father too. But from now on, you know him and see him. Philip said, Lord, show us the Father and that will be enough. Thank you for not even prompting. My God. Show us the Father and that will be enough. You know, both times Philip talks in John's Gospel, it's about enough. Remember the last time you talked about enough? Anybody remember? 5 barley loaves and 2 fish won't be enough?
Yes.
And now he's talking about a different kind of enough. That was the earthly enough, and this is the heavenly enough. You know, show us a sign, Lord. You know, we'll be satisfied. Just reveal God's glory in front of us. Then we'll believe. Well, sure, fellas. You know, you can hear the exasperation in Jesus' voice. Have I been with you people so long, Philip, and you've not come to know me? Don't you believe that I am in the Father and the Father is in me? And he goes on, you know, for a while with that. You know, they're getting pretty desperate. And I want to skip ahead a little bit for the sake of time here and look at some of the other pieces that relate to what we're about. One of the first there, near the end of chapter 14, looking at 26, 27, and so on. He says, well, remaining with you, I have said many things, but the Paraclete, Holy Spirit, which the Father will send in my name, that one will teach you all things and remind you of what I told you. Okay? Paraclete. Now, some of you who have borne with us for 9 sessions now, has anybody been here? Who's here the whole time? Nobody, so I'm not going to take the risk of repeating myself. I'm repeating myself, you just haven't heard it. Paraclete. Some of you might have been here when we looked at John 5, the first trial scene, after he healed the person. Is anybody here for that one? Okay, a couple of people. So I'll remind you that. Back in John 5, Jesus' first healing scene in Jerusalem, When there was the man who's been sitting by the pool for 38 years, waiting for someone to put him in the water, waiting for this magical healing. And Jesus heals him, and it's on the Sabbath, and the Judeans are going to, persecute him and eventually kill him because he's healing on the Sabbath and making God his father. We have this wonderful trial scene in accordance with the trial format of that time. Whereas we looked at later in the tabernacle story, trial is not about evidence and facts. It was about reputation and honor. If you are the accused, you need to call witnesses to defend your honor, and if then you attack the honor of your accusers. And the scene ends with Jesus telling the Judeans this terrible thing, that they have an accuser, Moses. Their accuser is Moses. The accuser, mythologically speaking, is who?
Satan.
Moses is their Satan. That's tough stuff, huh? The one in whom they put their hope, it says. Satan is the prosecuting attorney in this kind of courtroom battle of life. Satan is not the one, mythologically speaking, who whispers in your ear and tempts you. Satan is the one who goes before God and tells God how unworthy you are and all the terrible things. The book of Job is the classic example of that, right? Your servant Job will never believe in you. Put him to the test and you'll see. And so the Satan is the accuser. And now Jesus says, I'm going to give you a defense attorney. That's what paraclete is. Paraclete comes from the Greek secular image of one who is a defense attorney, one who stands up for you in court, an advocate. We still think of a defense attorney as an advocate, a court-appointed advocate for if you're poor. An advocate, someone who speaks on your behalf. Because either you're afraid or you're not educated or you don't know what to say. That's the only reason we need lawyers at all in court, right? It's because we don't have the words to defend ourselves. So we hire someone to defend us, to speak what needs to be said on our behalf. And Jesus says, I will send you an advocate. Now, the Greek word there, paraclete, also has echoes from the Hebrew scripture noun, different, of paraklesis, which means comfort. The form of the word that's used here, it can be translated either advocate or comforter, is not found anywhere in the Greek Bible other than the New Testament. But the Hebrew image of God being the one who provides comfort is certainly a common one, especially in the Psalms. And the image here in John's Gospel is that both those are the same reality, that you will find comfort in when you have one who will speak for you, who will shield you from your accusers, who will come in between you and those who charge you, with all these terrible things whose hostility is so threatening and frightening to us, the one who will intercede on your behalf. Okay? I will send you an advocate in the Father's name. And he says, I leave you peace. The peace will come back again in the resurrection scene in chapter 20. So we're going to look at that a little bit tomorrow. So I won't spend a lot of time on it today. But just to emphasize, there's a wonderful gospel hymn that goes along with it, the song that we sing in our church. So I always associate with it. If you don't know it, have your choir people learn it. He says, I give you peace, not the way the world gives it. How does the world give peace? Specifically at the time of John's gospel. What's the peace out there?
The peace of Rome.
Yeah, the Pax Romana. And so how does Rome provide peace?
Force. Politics.
National defense. That's how you provide peace. You got enough soldiers or enough weapons to shield the boundaries. That's how the world provides peace. And it goes all the way back to how Solomon provided peace in 1 Kings chapter 4. That's one of the first places we see that word in the social context. 1 Kings 4:25 in particular. Didn't bring my old Hebrew Bible with me. Oops. You can look it up for yourself. And it's a description of the peace that existed in Palestine under Solomon. And it's a picture of both economic prosperity and the national security state. It counts how many chariots and how many soldiers Solomon has and how they're stationed at all the boundaries. And within those boundaries, protected by soldiers and chariots and weapons, is this internal prosperity. And the subtext of it is, that there's also internal slavery and economic inequality and oppression and elitism and racism and all those dark sides of the national security state as well. And Jesus is suggesting, just as the prophet said at the time, when you rely on that, you've abandoned God. When Samuel the prophet, way back then, more than 1,000 years before the time of the New Testament, is upset, grieved, in the exact same language of this chapter, God says, don't worry, Samuel, they haven't abandoned you. They've abandoned me. They've shown they don't trust me. They put their trust in weapons, in gods of metal, rather than in me. And the same image comes up here. These people know precisely how the world gives peace. Rome gives peace through the national security state. And how did their leaders, the Judean leaders, provide peace? How did Nicodemus and the Sanhedrin provide peace?
Through the law?
Well, what was their relationship to Rome is kind of what I'm looking for.
Subservience. Subservience.
Accommodation. Right? They made a deal. Okay. They made a deal. They get to maintain their power as long as they become servants to Rome. We'll keep the people calm. We'll get them to pay their taxes. We'll get rid of any rebels that are trying to rouse people to rebellion against this foreign empire that's occupying the Holy Land. And we'll get to keep our power. That's how the world gives peace. And Jesus says, that's not how I give peace. And we'll look at the peace again a little bit tomorrow. If we live that way, the church would be a little bit different. Okay. Now, I just want to focus now on this image of vine and branches in chapter 15. It's a very powerful image. And it's in great contrast, and I would suggest, probably, we can never know for sure, but probably explicit contrast with another New Testament image. Of the church. I am the true vine, and my Father is the gardener, or the farmer. Every branch in me that does not bear fruit, he prunes. He cuts off. And everyone bearing fruit, he prunes, so it may bear more fruit. You are already clean because of the word I have spoken to you. You remember hearing about you were already clean just yesterday? You remember yesterday? I hear a couple nods. I don't know if you can hear it or not. That's not... back there in 13:10, the one who is bathed does not need other feet, more than their feet washed, but is wholly clean. You are clean. Now it is, you are already clean because of the word I have spoken. Remain in me and I in you. As the branch cannot bear fruit of itself unless it remains in the vine, in the same way, neither can you unless you remain in me. I am the vine and you are the branches. You are the branches. Okay? Vine and branches. What is, in just ordinary life, this relationship between a vine and branches?
The branch supports the end. Small.
Okay. I think you mean it the other way around, right? The vine supports the branches.
Yeah.
Right, okay. As he says quite explicitly, you cut the branch off, it's dead. Not good for anything except throwing the fire. Okay. Does he differentiate one branch from another branch at all?
No.
Not a bit. Now, what other image of the church here do we know from the New Testament? Hint, it's not in the Gospels.
The body.
Okay. Paul's famous metaphor from 1 Corinthians. Christ is the head of the body. The body has many members. And a hand can't say to the foot, I don't need you, etc. It's all one, but it's a differentiated body. And it's Paul's way of saying, as he says explicitly in 1 Corinthians 12 and the following, there are many gifts. One Spirit with many gifts. And there's, and he gives us a whole list of them. Some are prophets, some are teachers, some are apostles, etc. Some speak in tongues, some interpret tongues. In John's Gospel, it's everything is reduced to its essence. There's simply a vine and branches. In John's Gospel's community, I think it was a central aspect of what it meant to be church, that there would not be any offices in the church. There would not be people who are teachers or people who are prophets or people who are apostles. Not to say those functions wouldn't take place. And the Spirit might blow on you to be a teacher today and you to speak in tongues tomorrow and you to exercise leadership the next day. But just because you're called to exercise leadership tomorrow doesn't mean you're always going to be the leader. That's trying to box in the spirit, which blows where it wills. We think that because someone has a gift to exercise one day, that that's their permanent gift. And this gospel's view is not that way. These are not necessarily talents we're born with, and therefore we're ordained to exercise them on behalf of the community till death. But they are gifts of the Spirit, and they can be given and taken away. I think it was this gospel's community's way of recognizing that once we start thinking of ourselves in institutional office terms, we start to like it. We start to recognize that there's some human glory in that, you know, to be treated as pastors or as teachers or whatever else it might be. And it's this way of kind of keeping the ground unstable under our feet a little bit so that we rely on God rather than relying on that we've designated you as the teacher, so you're the official spokesperson for all. You teach us the Bible. The rest of us don't have to be responsible for it. You know, you take care of the money, and you know, we'll defer to you. That eventually, ultimately, all these responsibilities belong to the community as a whole under the guidance of Jesus in the form of this new one, the advocate, this paraclete. Okay. Now, that's a very difficult model of church to practice. Very difficult. Because how do you know? How do you know who's the teacher today and who's the leader tomorrow? You know? Just because someone says so? You know? Well, I've got a new insight from God, and let me share it with you all. And you all just say, okay, tell it to us, brother. You know?
It's obvious. He's the one who has the best mailing list.
It's very difficult.
Just points out subtly to me how tremendously important that these people learned the scripture.
Yeah.
Because they didn't have a stack of them over in the corner.
That's right.
If they're going to preserve the message, they had to learn it.
That's right. They had to learn it. And they had to learn how to pray and take their time. You know, there was a conversation earlier this week, or was it last week, about Holden? No, I guess it was the forum last week. About the church, you know, the church generally reaching decisions by consensus or by hierarchical fiat or different ways. And we're all in our culture very impatient with the waste of time that consensus is. You know, I know the answer. Why do we have to hear from everybody? Let's just get on with it. You know, we got work to do. Well, that's our American spirit coming through, I would suggest. That's not the gospel. That's our, you know, let's be practical. Let's get things done. The purpose of life is to accomplish things and get things done. Build more buildings, have more programs, raise more money. You know, and the gospel could care less about any of those things. You know, that's American culture. Which isn't to say it's bad, but it's to say that we need to recognize that that's, you know, something we're imposing on the church out of our culture and not coming up from our tradition. The tradition is much more about take your time, listen. People ever thought about the root of the word obedience? To be obedient means to listen. It doesn't mean to be subservient to authority. It means to listen. And listening takes time. You have to discern. That's the language of 1 John. Discern the spirits. Not every spirit is from God. So you have to discern the spirits. You have to know both through paying attention to the scriptures, respecting the wisdom of those whose lives reflect holiness, not who hold institutional offices necessarily. Those, of course, aren't necessarily inconsistent either. It's not saying that just because you're a church leader, therefore you shouldn't be listened to. No, it's not anti-church leaders. It's just trying to, you know, make that not the ultimate source of authority. If people exercise leadership or authority in the church because they live lives of true shepherdhood, they love the people so much they're willing to let go of everything in their own lives for the sake of the community, then maybe they have some real wisdom. But not just because they sit in an office in the building and they're on the church salary. You know, that's a process that takes time, and it takes, as we saw yesterday, a sense of intimacy. Well, if I know you, I know your heart, I know what motivates you, and if you're saying those things to us, we should listen. We should be obedient. It's not just coming out of the blue at us. It's coming out of a sense that we really know one another. And that, I think, can only happen in small community. The fundamentalists, ironically, know this better than most of us mainstream Christians. Most fundamentalist churches that are, even the huge ones that are thousands of people, know the key to that are little cell groups of 10 or 12. So when they come to their, you know, gigantic congregations of thousands, that's just a grand celebration. But that's not the community. The community are these little groups. Just like we recognize in our body that we have organs and tissues and ultimately individual cells. We're not just one big mass of cells. You know, our cells work together in small units, and those small units comprise the bigger unit. Here it's a vine and branches. That is this image of an undifferentiated body always connected with the love of Jesus. I just have a few minutes to go here, and so I just want to focus on one more theme, and that's a sense of hate. What associations do people have with the term hate? What does it mean to hate something?
Like you said before, in our culture, it's just the flippant thing. I hate broccoli, or I hate driving in the rush hour or something like that.
Something unpleasant.
Something you don't like.
Yeah. Something you prefer not to have around you. What do you think it means in the religious sense? What's Jesus talking about here? I commanded in 15:17. This is what I command you. Love one another. If the world hates you, know that it hated me before it hated you. If you were part of the world would be fond of what is its own. But because you are not part of the world, but I have chosen you out of the world, because of this, the world hates you.
Wouldn't that be opposes?
Yeah, that's what I think it comes down to, opposes. When God is said in the Psalms to hate somebody, it's not this angry emotion, I hate you! You know what your little kid says to you, it's a sense of opposition.
They don't want to deal with it, they don't want to be confronted with it.
Yeah, I have nothing to do with you. It's the opposite of love. If love is what brings people together, hate is what pushes people apart.
It's a real separation.
Yeah, separation. It's not necessarily that ugly emotion that we're embarrassed by and we try and avoid acknowledging that we ever feel, which is anger. Anger is a very different thing than hatred, at least in the biblical sense. They may coincide sometimes, but they may not. You know, so to say the world hates you may not necessarily suggest that the world is angry with you, but says the world wants to have nothing to do with you, is opposed to you. The spirit of the world is opposed to the spirit of the gospel. And that's precisely what he goes on to say. And remember this connection with foot washing. Remember the word I said to you, a slave is not greater than the master. Foot washing. If they persecuted me, they will persecute you. And then sarcastically, if they kept my word, they will keep yours too. Lest we think that we're going to be so effective in our preaching and witnessing here. But they do all these things against you. See, the emphasis now is on us, not on Jesus. Because of my name, because they don't know the one that sent me. If I had not come and spoken to them, they would have no sin. But now they have no pretext for their sin. The one who hates me hates also my Father. This word pretext is an interesting one in the biblical sense. So, it has to do with a cover story. You know, a lie you tell to shield yourself, to shield other people, shield yourself from what having other people know you. It's the precise opposite of what the foot washing is inviting us to. You know, there we're invited to have no pretext, to be exposed and vulnerable in front of each other. And this is saying they have pretext for their sin. If we were to look back in chapter 3, where it was night, after Jesus has talked to Nicodemus, he said, this is why they prefer darkness to the light, because they can hide the dark, hide their evil deeds in the darkness. The darkness is the cover for sin. And Jesus says, now they have no cover. It's been exposed. You know, you've learned how to see. It's not fooling you anymore. You can see that just because they're religious leaders doesn't mean that they understand who God is. Okay, well, it's 10 o'clock. My watch doesn't have 10 o'clock. I'm going to go on for a couple of minutes, if you don't mind. Just a couple more things briefly, because I know this is a lot. It was a lot for the disciples, too. Beginning of 16, I've said these things so you will not be scandalized. People will expel you from the synagogue. In fact, the hour is coming. See, it's their hour now. When everyone who kills you are thinking they are serving God. Tough stuff, huh? But they will do these things because they've come to know neither me nor my Father. But I've said these things to you, so when the hour for them comes, you will remember that I told you. I just want to jump ahead to a little comic relief, because it is heavy stuff, I realize. Let's look at 16, 17, and 18. I just love this scene. Therefore, let's see, let me go back to 16. In a little while you will see me no longer, and again you will see me. In a little while you will see me. 17. Therefore, some of the disciples said to one another, what does this mean when he says to us, in a little while you will not see me, in a little while you will see me again, and because I'm going to the Father? And hence they began to say, what does he mean by this a little while? We don't know what he's talking about.
There's the first word of honesty that they've shown.
Darn right. They don't have a clue, and they're finally acknowledging it. And, you know, I'm glad we can see that as funny, and I hope we can laugh at ourselves in the same way. Lest we think we understand exactly what this gospel is about, and we wouldn't be like these disciples, these dumb, stupid disciples. Well, they're just like us.
Just dumb fishermen. They don't know what they're talking about.
They what?
They're just dumb fishermen.
Yeah, dumb fishermen and, you know, carpenters and those kinds of
tax collectors.
Right. And it's really there to give us a little comic relief, I think, in the midst of our saying, you know, we don't know what Jesus is talking about. And I think it's there to help us just to stay with it and to recognize that ultimately this isn't about understanding in our head. You know, he said over and over again, you will remember. I've told you these things now. So when it happens, you'll think back. So you'll have these stories. So when you go out there in the world where you think, we're gonna go out there so filled with the love of God, everyone's going to see how loving it is, and they're all going to become Christians, and everything's going to be happily ever after. And you're going to go out there and think, wait a minute here, folks. You know, it's not happening according to the script that we thought it was. Then you can go back and say, wait a minute, Jesus told us it was going to be just like this. Now we understand. Now that we've had the experience, now we can go back and tell the stories again and again. And now they become comfort for us instead of just, you know, confusing, bizarre, abstract words. The Last Supper discourse ends with Jesus' prayer to God, the only time in this gospel he's explicitly praying on behalf of this community. At the end of the story of Lazarus, before he actually calls Lazarus out of the tomb, he offers a prayer to God, and he says he's doing it for the sake of the crowd. Here it's for the sake of the community, and not just the community then, but us. Explicitly us. Verse 7, 17:20, I ask not only about these, but about those who believe in me through their word, so that they may be one, just as you, Father, are in me, and I in you, that they may be in one with us, so the world may believe that you sent me. So ultimately, all this discourse is there to try and give us the capacity to be one. Out there in a world that's going to try and divide us. It divides us into churches against each other, you know, Protestants against Catholics, Lutherans against Methodists, ad nauseum. You know, divides us into people, Americans against Russians, and white people against people of color, and men against women, and, you know, that we can be one. Because if we get divided amongst ourselves, then we suffer that same fate of betrayal that they suffered, and they're scattered. And that's the end of that. But if somehow we can remember these stories and recognize that this is always the way it's been for the church. It's always been the struggle to be in the world but not of the world, and it's never been easy. But in the end, we know that Jesus and the Paraclete are there with us, that we're not doing this just because of our own strength, but we're there because the one who sent Jesus also sends us. Okay, I will stop. Hopefully, some of you will still be here tomorrow, and we will look at some very hopeful scenes. We will obviously not going to look at the whole Passion and Resurrection story in an hour. But I just want to focus on one scene with Jesus on the cross and then look at some resurrection stories so we can finish our time together and go back to wherever we're from, filled with the hope and enthusiasm to go out and try and live some of the story ourselves. Thanks. You can cut the tape now, Jennifer.